Welcome, everybody, to episode 308 of WordPress Weekly for Wednesday, March 14th, 2017, also known as Pi Day. And it just so happens that we started the show at 3:14 p.m. on 3:14, 2017. So
it is kind of too bad. It needs to be episode 314. We're off by four, Jeff.
We're off by six.
You said 308?
Yeah, this is 308.
We're off by six. Yeah, see, this is why you don't trust me with numbers.
That's right. So I'm your host, Jeff Chandler, joined by John.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff. Jacoby. Hey, you didn't let me finish your name. See, you thought I was just going to say John.
I did think you were just going to say John. I mean, I just say Jeff. Does anybody refer to you as Jeff Chandler?
No.
Like Jeff Chandler with the evening news.
No. Thank God. No.
No.
So let's see. Today's Wednesday. It's also Pi Day. So we have a local joint here called Baker Square, and they serve delicious pies. So I don't know if I get out and about today, maybe I'll go stop up there and get a free slice of pie. What the hell, John? What's your favorite kind of pie? Let's go right off the beaten path already.
Wow, straight out of the gate.
Let's go right off topic.
I'm gonna go. So there's a place that's local to where I live that is famously known for making apple pies in a paper bag. Okay. And so shout out to them. They would be my favorite pie. You know, support local and all that.
Apple pie with a good old hot apple pie with some vanilla bean ice cream on top, man. That's what I'm talking about.
We have a Baker Square here too. I wonder if clearly it must be a chain, but Midwest thing, maybe? I don't know. I guess I never really thought about it.
I don't know. But their pies are, they're known for their pies here. We do have some sad news to tell you. Oh, go ahead.
Wait, what's your pie? What's your favorite pie? I can't just ask me and not. Everyone cares more about it.
I like a good slice of pumpkin pie, apple pie, or peanut butter and chocolate pie.
That doesn't count.
Come on, man.
Pudding with a crust around it is cheating. That's just pudding.
Well,
I mean, I'm all right with it.
But tastes pretty good at Baker Square, I'll tell you that much. Or that one apple pie where it's got crumbles, like cinnamon sugar crumbles on top of it. That's usually pretty good as well.
Is this like that outtake of Rick and Morty where they talked about ice cream forever? We're just going to talk about pie forever?
No, we're not going to talk about pie forever. In fact,
the whole episode is dedicated only to pie.
Oh, I sure hope not. We do want to pass along our condolences to the Hawking family, the passing of physicist Stephen Hawking, age 76, huge loss to the world, very bright individual. And it was pretty cool to see some tweets out there, especially one from the Big Bang Theory. You know, it took me a while to get into that show, but once I did, man, I really appreciate the humor in that show, and I love the episode they did where Sheldon was playing, I think it was Words with Friends with Stephen Hawking, and that was that was pretty good. So we lost a great and very smart individual, and always enjoyed his thoughts on the cosmos and how we're insignificant here on this planet in the grand scheme of things. So
yeah, I feel like that should be pretty obvious, but apparently it's not.
It's not. You're begging me to rip off this the lid off this thing. And I've thought about this a lot on how how our insignificance as
creatures, people.
As George Carlin.
George's favorite.
Just the fact that as far as we know. No, we're the only ones out there. We're the only sort of really smart species out there. And, you know, it'd be really sad to find out if we were really, truly all alone out there. But, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, on this planet, we're insignificant. We're here. We're living out our lives. We're doing our thing. And, you know, we got all these different human-made problems and everything else on here. But, you know, there's gamma ray, there's X-ray bursts, there's huge meteors, that there are things beyond human control that we cannot stop that could wipe out civilization. And that, to me, is so sobering to think about.
You know, I think most people would agree. If only this were Philosophy Weekly instead of WordPress Weekly.
I know.
Because I could talk. I could talk about it all day.
I know also, you talk about most things all day.
I know.
But yeah. Anyways, that's my take on. You know, maybe one day we'll do a show where it's just nothing but no WordPress, just everything else.
That's a different podcast altogether. We'll have nobody will tune in. We have no credibility when it comes to any of that stuff.
All right,
but someone may tune in to be entertained.
Let's get back on track. There's actually quite a few interesting things to talk about outside, a little bit outside the land of WordPress. In fact, well, let's start off with the Stack Overflow survey results for 2018. So Stack Overflow, it's a huge Q&A, question and answer community for developers across the world. And they've been conducting the survey, I believe, since 2011. And this year, it was held in January, between January 8th and the 28th. It includes responses from over 100,000 developers from 183 countries across the world. This is actually about twice as many respondents compared to last year's survey. So it's nice to see that every year they're progressively getting more responses to the survey. Now,
how many of those do you think were Russian hackers, Jeff?
Oh,
no, I mean, if we're talking about philosophy, we as well go politics and everything.
I don't know, but
just keep going.
Good question, though. I wish I had a rim shot. That was pretty good there. But last year, WordPress was the third most dreaded software platform behind Salesforce and SharePoint. And this year, WordPress has moved up in the rankings and is now the sixth most dreaded platform, according to respondents. Respondents found Windows Phone, Mainframe, Salesforce, Drupal, and SharePoint to be more dreadful. And now, you know, this is no strange place for WordPress to be in the survey. Ever since they've done the survey, WordPress has consistently ranked near the top in the survey for being the most dreadful platform. And I've kind of wondered why, but I've got some ideas as to why in various comment threads on Hacker News and Reddit and other places where conversations take place about WordPress. And I think asking developers why is probably akin to opening Pandora's box. Maybe you don't want to go there. Maybe you do. I don't know. But John, I'm going to put you on the spot here. since you're the developer type, take a stab at it. Why do you think, give us your top three reasons as to why you think WordPress is a dreadful platform for so many people, at least to these respondents. So,
obviously, full disclosure, I don't think WordPress is that dreadful to work with. So I'm not the right person to answer this question. But I think if you ask anyone what they don't like, or, hey, tell me what you don't like about this thing, you'll find something you don't like, and then that will be the thing. We're trying to sell our house right now, and watching people walk through our home and pick things apart to figure out what they don't like about it, they're going to find a million things. But do you want or need a home? If you do, then WordPress is as good as any other thing to hate, I guess, right? So when one of the survey questions is very self-fulfilling to say, of these things, which thing do you hate? Because everyone is going to hate on something. And the chances are that you actually end up, there's like a fire and ice problem here. Like, you end up hating the thing that you love the most. Like, people that are deep into WordPress are going to know a million other different reasons to hate it that most other people won't know. So is it dreadful? Sure, in a million ways. But it's also delightful in a million other ways, too. So I think it's a hilarious question that I hope they kind of stick around with. But I also think the results of the, like, most dreaded platform is, like, the most silly and kind of useless result of all of them.
Okay. You know, some of the things, like, I could probably.
Jeff, what's your most dreaded pie? What's the pie that you dread the most? when someone's like, "Here's a warm, room temperature cherry pie."
Yeah,
add that to the like. No, you don't want.
I want ice cold cherry pie.
Right. And so, if it was on a list of, like, dreaded pies, you'd be like, "Of course, I could. That's disgusting. No, of course, I don't want that."
Well, I think, you know, some of the reasons they mean, well, the arguments are, well, WordPress is not modern, it's not object oriented,
well, sure, it's not MVC,
it's not doing all these things I just learned in college in computer engineering, you know, stuff like that. think are some of the reasons why it's probably the most dreaded. Who knows?
It doesn't make any sense. It's disorganized. It uses a lot of memory. It's susceptible to getting hacked all the time. Yum, yum, yum.
It's just a giant bowl of spaghetti.
And those, and the thing is, they're all valid reasons. Yeah. They're all 100% valid. So it's not that anybody's reason isn't right, because they are. They're all. But you look at any mature platform 15 years old, I mean, I will come up with as many excuses or reasons as there are reasons to dread using WordPress. So that's why I don't find it dreadful. That's why generally I stay pretty positive about all of the things, SharePoint, Drupal, Salesforce. I really don't care. They're all going to be not good if you have to use them to solve some problem. They're really great when you get to use them for fun things. So I just happen to be able to use WordPress for fun things, so I don't find it dreadful at all.
Well, other bits about the survey. Big surprise. JavaScript was once again the most popular technology with HTML, CSS, and SQL followed closely behind. And among the various JavaScript frameworks and libraries that are out there, Node.js is the most commonly used, followed by Angular and React.
You know, we'll have made it when Gutenberg is on the list as a platform. It's just like up there, past WordPress. Like, people actually like using WordPress because they don't like using Gutenberg. Is that does that mean that you made it? That's what Chris Rock said. And like, that's how you know that you made it, is that everybody hates you. So we're trying to take a little bit away from you. So maybe that's a good thing.
I found this. There's a lot of actually interesting tidbits and questions to the survey, but they actually added two new topics this year. One was about artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. and the other was about ethics. And I thought one of the interesting questions about ethics is that when posed with a hypothetical situation in which a developer was asked if they would write code for unethical purposes, more than half of the respondents said no. Mm. And they also asked a couple of other questions where, well, would you... who do you believe is responsible for the unethical code? And the majority of respondents said upper management. And the lowest response was the actual developer who wrote the code. Mm-hmm. And there were other questions like, well, would you tell upper management, or would you tell the people responsible if code was unethical? And the majority of people said, well, it depends. You know, right. And what the survey showed was that, you know, for a lot of developers out there, at least those specifically tied to the survey, is there's a lot of gray areas involved for with sure. ethics around code. And this is, in fact, I'm going to work on getting Morten Rand Hendrickson on the show to talk about this subject more in depth. Because he wrote a very long in-depth, he's doing a lot of research about this topic. And I thought it was just interesting to think about the mm-hmm. ethics of code, you know, and who's responsible. And I was kind of reassured and happy with the fact that, you know, at least 80% of the people who responded said no, they would not write unethical code if asked to do so.
I was happy to see that they framed it as it being unethical, because I think that really positions that question nicely, because most of engineering, I don't care if it's architecture or software, or if it's in the real world or whatever else, is overcoming really hard problems, or problems that exist because you're working against the grain, or you're doing something that isn't really meant to be done, right? Like, the most fascinating architecture in the world, like, defies gravity, right? Like, and that is something that is, it's a hard problem. It's a thing that shouldn't work, but then you have to work really hard to make it work. But the difference between it being unethical is that, like, you're doing it because, like, the results of your code are, like, obviously unethical, but you know, they're for bad reasons or for bad intent or ill will or for, you know, because I would argue when we were kids, that's how most people that are our age learned how to code, was by hacking on stuff, like figuring ways in and out of systems and things that they were never supposed to be in, but it was just because some school administrator had a password as their password on the network, and all of a sudden you dork around. Everybody went to school with some kid who knew how to get into stuff, and like you go to prison for that now, even though you're not even really hacking anything. Like, yeah. So I think they did a good job of framing that question, because it could have gone in a lot of different directions. I think they did a good job.
There's a whole session called Technology and Society. And one of the questions was, what do developers think is dangerous and exciting about AI? And there really wasn't
Stephen Hawking had lots of opinions on this too.
Yeah, so there's four answers here, and it was kind of the same distribution of responses by there's 63,000 responses, and there's about 20% for or you know, anywhere between 25-28% responded to algorithms making important decisions, artificial intelligence surpassing human intelligence, aka the singularity, evolving the definitions of fairness in algorithmic versus human decisions, and increasing automation of jobs. And all of those answers, which were listed under dangerous, were sort of answered unanimously. And when it comes to exciting, 40% of respondents said increasing automation of jobs, which, I thought that was interesting.
Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk both have like famously said, and all of us have probably said it or paraphrased it a dozen times in different ways, but the part of it with AI specifically to this that I'm reminded of is not just like the singularity, which is, you know, kind of an inevitability at this point, but that we have lots of evidence to support the fact that every type of algorithm or thing that we have used or deployed that is kind of software based is not really working for us yet. A lot of this stuff is largely working against us, not like as a global problem, but really that the distribution of wealth has meant that we trust our your mortgage to an algorithm that is a credit score. And so it makes it harder for people to have a home, which is sort of like one of the core fundamental things that every human needs is a place to sleep safely. And so if the algorithm decides whether what your worthiness is to have a place to live, and the algorithm says no, then people who already have good credit continue to have good credit, and people that don't have good credit will only continue to have bad credit until they get lucky or like land a job to help level them up or some, like, it just, we don't have a lot of evidence that says that algorithms around the world are like doing amazing things. And so we need to see more of the good than we really end up suffering the repercussions of all the bad stuff.
And when it comes to algorithms and the people behind them, you know, the human beings that are creating them, it reminded me of a session by Andrew Nason about some of the work he was doing in government. I tried to find it on WordPress.tv. I couldn't find it, but he talked about the bias that could be placed into the algorithms, whether that's race or gender or what have you, and that this bias comes from the people who are creating the algorithms. And I thought that's really something to ponder when you have algorithms or algorithmic based things, you know, making these really important decisions or qualifications for you, but because of possibly inherited bias from the individual developers who created it, you get shafted.
Right. You totally do. My last comment on the matter is that we, and I've probably said it in a before, but maybe not, is that for a really long time ago, people used to say that scholars, philosophers used to compare people to the elements. They'd say that the human mind is like water, or it flows, or it's like air, and it's like the wind, or, you know, the soul is like whatever, right? Like for a really long time, before we had computers, we would compare things to elements, to the things around us. But once we invented computers, the idea that the human mind is a lot like a computer became really sticky. There's like articles on the web. I'm doing a terrible job paraphrasing it. Find it on your own. But that really, because we invented computers, we kind of did create them in our own image. Sort of have like a nervous system and a short-term memory and a long-term memory, and things kind of work the way our brains work in a very simple level. And so when it comes to AI, the AI is doing what a human brain would do at a very low level without the additional context yet. And that's the part of it that we don't have, is kind of the spongy adaptation, like the no Siri, no Google, no Alexa, no anything, knows how to compensate in the squishy way that a human brain can. Your AI needs to, for it to work in the way that actually benefits us. Because I need to start taking like clips from the Nest camera that we have in the house to take outtakes of like Siri fails, because I have a 0% success rate with Siri. It never, ever, ever works for me. And it's things that I feel like should be really simple that are, they never, ever work. Or it misunderstands what I'm saying in ways that I didn't even compensate for knowing how to compensate for it. And so that is the problem with AI across the board in general. AI and algorithms, from credit scores to personal assistance, if it can't adapt on the fly for what the request is, like a person's brain can, it will never, ever, ever, ever work. And this middle ground while we're figuring it out is really, really painful on like a daily basis. You tell Siri to turn your lights off in some room and it plays music for no reason. Or like it just is, it's ridiculous. John Gruber had a good rant about it on his talk show a couple of weeks ago. But man, the AI thing is tough. Eventually WordPress is going to need some version of AI. We kind of have a Kismet, which is sort of AI, but there will be other bits, right? Like after the deadline was kind of a way of doing that locally, but eventually we're going to need some level of like fact checking.
There we go. I think we're right now we're getting a scoop on a new Jetpack module. WordPress AI. Thank you, John.
Well, that's imagine that, right? Like that's the way to do it, and it wouldn't be that far away. I don't think we'll pretend like we're surprised when it happens, but when a Jetpack module comes out to start doing some like bulk processing of content that is beyond just a Kismet, I for one will not be shocked, because they have the computational power of all of WordPress.com, a history of a Kismet, everything else. They are positioned to make the best decision on any. They have the most data, and so they're Jetpack and our friends at Automattic are in literally the best position possible to start actually making some correlation and advanced AI decisions about whatever than anyone else in the WordPress space is, I think.
So on the previous couple episodes, we've talked about AMP a good bit, and David Dieter Bohn of The Verge had an exclusive interview with two Google executives about a blog post that Google had published. He talked to David Besbury, VP of Search Engineering at Google, and Monte Ubel, engineering lead for AMP. And it's a very enlightening article about what Google's plans are for AMP. And really, to kind of summarize it, is that Google understands the flack that it has received from the open web community. And they've since published a blog post that outlines their plans. And actually what their plans have been for AMP all along that have actually kind of been misunderstood and I guess, I don't know, maybe not say taken the wrong way, but the concerns have maybe been really hard to I don't know, get around or whatnot. But but what Google plans on doing is taking all the bits and pieces and things that they've learned from AMP that could be applied universally and go to the various standard bodies and try and make them standards to make the web a better place, the mobile web a better place for everyone without the requirement of AMP.
Right.
And some of the proposed standards that they talk about is feature policy, web packaging, iframe promotion, performance timeline, and pink timing. Some of those get pretty technical in nature, but the fact is, you know, with W3C, the various bodies, the standards, it's going to take a while
for sure,
for these things to be discussed and talked through. But one of the things that they said in the blog post, and I'll quote this because I think it really illustrates what we've been talking about for the past couple of weeks, is that, quote, "The intention here is to be better about communicating our intent. We've always wanted to make the technology behind AMP a web standard and always said this, but not very clearly. We just want to communicate very clearly that AMP is not anything other than trying to make the web better. The lessons learned from AMP are being put into the standard body so we can have other frameworks implement the same stuff too," end quote. So if you take that into consideration and what they're working on with AMP, now the relationship between Automattic and Google's AMP team and what they're working on makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it does. But I don't think that that's a problem for – I don't think that that's the problem that the global web development community, the skeptics – I don't think that that's the problem. I think the problem is almost solely based on the fact that AMP pages are hosted by Google, basically, right? Like, they just slurp the content, and then you end up with a Google – like an AMP site. It's an AMP, it's a way to give your content very specifically to Google. It is a Google-centric thing. And so
that's how it started, but we're seeing now that they're creating ways to be able to have AMP-like functionality without Google.
But we didn't have the same kind of nobody was drinking the like Twitter Bootstrap haterade for the same reason, right? It was people didn't like Bootstrap because it looked too bootstrappy, but Bootstrap, in a sense, and to this quote, was trying to solve the same problem. They wanted a universal UI for the web. They wanted a. We've had the same crap for operating systems for a while, even though we lack tabs and we lack basic stuff. The only UI we've ever had that's universal across the web is buttons, list boxes, links, windows, iframes. It's the same junk that we've had for 30 years. We haven't had a universal tab or menu items or anything else. There's no unified version of that. Twitter came along and said, hey, for the web, let's make buttons look the same, links look the same, everything else kind of have a universal foundation and then branch off of that. And if AMP was that for the mobile web, is a different proposition than them having started by hosting all of the AMP pages themselves. By doing that, they may have made it easier on themselves to solve this problem, but they have almost forever tainted the reputation of any problem that they solve going forward, because the perception will always be that Google is only doing it to sell ads, to drive traffic, and not to make the web a better place. They started in the wrong direction, and it's going to be really hard for them to course correct and have everyone that was hating them before go, oh, yeah, I totally believe them now. It's going to be really tough.
And this is that point that was actually brought up in the article on The Verge where he says Google faced a choice. Take the time to try and convince the web standards body to adopt it, go that way, or use Google's own, use it on Google's own products, primarily search. And he said they needed a vehicle to actually figure it out. They couldn't actually try it out. So this is actually the way it went. And yeah, maybe this is like you said.
So, you know what has worked though, historically, at least in the WordPress community, is an apology. How about, hey, we're Facebook. Our licensing clause was wrong. This whole React thing was like our bad. We were trying to do the right thing, but we listened and we learned. We're sorry. Here's the new, better thing that we're doing. We haven't really gotten that, I don't think, yet about AMP. Like, they're still iterating and still chipping away at it. If the next version was like, hey, y'all, we are sorry for the way that this started. Here's the new version that we want y'all to try. Is a different way to start that conversation, I guess. And it seemed to have worked for React. And I hope that, as unlikely as it is that anyone is listening or that I'm even remotely correct about any of this, that if there is a thing that's happening coming down the pipeline like that, that someone thinks about it in that way, because that has worked historically really well, at least for the open web. And I think that's what AMP needs. It's not a technical problem. It's not a leadership problem. It's not a personality problem. It's not even a Google company problem, I don't think. It's that they worked fast. They did it remote. They did it on their own. And they did it closed. I mean, they did it the way that you have to do things as a big company. Own it, take it, run in a corner, make something better, and you have to compromise a little bit in order to do that. And so what they compromised was the openness of it in the get-go. And so convincing open-spirited folks that, yeah, hey, we're open now, an apology is a good place to start. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong.
At the end of the article, I think it was really cool. He says, as we start wrapping up our discussion about AMP, Besbreeze repeats one of my questions back at me. He says, have we just been idiots around communicating this stuff? And yes, he replies. and you know, in some cases, in this article, it sort of reminded me a bit of Gutenberg and how Gutenberg was first brought out and how everybody thought it was just going to be about the editor and how it merged into this thing about, well, the editor's just a start and it's going to evolve into editing and block-based all your content, customizer, that experience. And so many of the communication issues wrapped around that were it just in the beginning days of Gutenberg, people thought, well, this is the way it's going to be. It's going to be bad. It's going to be crap. Everything's going to break. And they've now had, as Gutenberg's gotten better, now the communication has gotten to the point where now we're talking about refinements and transition periods and stuff like that. There seem to be some parallels there, but that I noticed with AMP and Gutenberg.
Communication is tough as an individual or as a team working remotely. Yeah,
we've covered that on the show a few times before.
Yeah, we have. And it's a thing that, like, on a personal level, it's easier said than done. And I will continue to struggle with it on like a daily basis, because it's kind of easier to do stuff than it is to repeatedly communicate about the things that you are doing or that you have done. Like, I like to think that it's okay to just trust that, like, we're all doing the right thing. But the reality is that if you don't say what you're doing or keep people updated with what you've been working on, or people can't see the progress that you've been making, then that really it completely eliminates all of the forward motion that you've made, because there's no evidence of any forward motion at all. You're not talking about what you're doing. So that was Gutenberg in the early days. That was Buddy Press in some of the early days. That was one of the things that Pippin has always done really well on every plugin and project that he's had. It's just communication about everything all the time. Here it is. Go, go, go. And so it's kind of nice to watch a group like some really smart, talented folks at Google screw it up. But at the same time, it kind of proves how important that it is. So it's good for them to recognize it, I think.
So TechCrunch, that site's still around. I haven't read it in a long time, but I found out they've redesigned.
Of course, it's still around.
They've not only redesigned, but they've rebuilt. So TechCrunch is actually on WordPress. They use a VIP hosting, and they came out with this article talking about they not just redesigned the website, they rebuilt it, and now it is a decoupled or headless version of WordPress, where the front end is now in the form of a single page style React app. So it's decoupled from the WordPress back end. And they worked with HumanMade to extensively use the WordPress REST API. And I like their take on it, that the publishing and editing and content experience in WordPress is best of class. And it doesn't make any sense to sort of reinvent the wheel on that. So let's just use what we have, and then we could build on top of that. So they built a React or Redo app for their front end that reads JSON data from the REST API.
And they used a different company for some of the design and layout. They used Working Company for so it's really smart, I think, to use the people that are pros at like the very specific things that they're pros at.
So they've if you browse around the website now, each article sort of pops up. It has a little X. You can close it. It takes you back to the main page. The website is insanely fast. I don't know it's been fast.
It's fast in the same crappy, misleading way.
Oh, okay. Smarty pants.
No offense. This is not like a dig on anybody. This is definitely not a dig on the folks at Human Made or anybody. This is not about them. This is just about the, like, you know, I'm old school about all this stuff. And the whole, like, well, the time to first bite is a lie if the time to the last bite is like a second and a half later. And so, sure, you go to the TechCrunch website, you click on events, and you click on gadgets, and it loads instantly. And then there's 2 seconds of nothing. And then stuff appears. And so then you click events, same thing. You click on gadgets, okay, well, it caches some stuff locally. That's great. But your first time loading stuff is not fast. It is a lie. And so that bugs me a little bit. The same as the Netflix app on every Apple TV or Xbox or PlayStation works. It's a lie. And so it's misleadingly fast. And anyone who has grown up with the web can see it plain as day. It's the corn syrup of the web. Like, yeah, it's restful. Sure. It's an app, whatever, but it's not sugar. It's not what you expect. It's not what you want.
They decided to ship now. They have a bunch of ideas.
It's good.
Is it going to be working on it? Yeah, yeah. Implement
I get it.
It. Maybe they'll
do something this,
to please
again,
your
sounds,
crumpy butt.
I know. It sounds more negative than I mean for it to be, because I get how it works. I know that it's the future, .. I totally am not trying
to be.
It's
the coupled REST API, man.
I get it, and that's good. It needs to happen. It has to happen over and over and over again. I mean, I would prefer GraphQL, but that's a different story. It's still good to see. It looks beautiful. I mean, TechCrunch has always kind of been like the website that tried newer designs before other people. Like, they were kind of ahead of the game a little bit. It reminds me a lot of the
this design kind of reminds me of the 2016 thing. I don't know.
It reminds me of the typical trendy, like, iOS app, Snapchat, like, card style, big chunky title, subtitles, snippet of content, and then like click to go deeper. Like, it's the same. It's a different version of the same thing that we've all kind of swung to, and I'm okay with that. It doesn't look bad.
I was browsing the new design on my iPhone. It was pretty nice, easy to read. I thought it was nice. Now, we didn't talk about this with AMP and the mobile web, and I wanted to rant about it a little bit.
Please do. Everyone's sick of listening to me. Everyone wants to hear
you about it. I think we've ranted about it for a while, and I've said this on Twitter, but browsing the web on mobile, even if you have a great connection, is just a horrible experience. If you visit like my local news websites, Channel 3, Channel 5, Channel 8, and you're browsing news stories, there's ads, there's things that pop up, like for my local news site. Now, I'm reading an article, and next thing you know, I get this big thing that pops up on my iPhone that says,
"Oh yeah,
Amazon gift card giveaway." Like, yeah, okay, sure. You can't close it out. You don't know what's going on. And I'm wondering, hey, don't these people at this organization know what's going on? How many people are probably getting scammed by these pop-ups or what they're using? And just browsing the web on mobile sucks.
We ruined it. I said this before. We totally ruined the web. And so this was part of the question that about being ethical, writing ethical code, that is the ads, those kind of ads that are obtrusive, that autoplay, pop-ups, redirects, they're toxic to the web, and they are rampant on like media, smaller but local like media sites. To your point, Jeff, they are rampant. You go to your local NBC news site, and you're right. Unless you have a pie hole set up at home or an Eero that does like ad blocking from the cloud, unless you have something to block those ads, they make it impossible to do the only thing you wanted to do. Like, if every time you opened your refrigerator, you had to watch an ad in order to get a glass of milk.
Oh, my God.
That's where we're at. All I want to do is read your website, and I can't because there's pop-ups and ads and crap in the way.
And sometimes these news sites actually redirect me to an entirely different page while I'm reading the news article.
So at home, when we got when I abandoned the Apple routers and got Eero's, Eero's have been really great in my experience so far. But they part of the Eero Plus option is that they'll do ad blocking like in the cloud, and so all of every device, iPhones, iPads, everything, the Apple TV, they've been pretty clever about like circumventing the ad thing. But originally, Eero Plus would block ads on like the YouTube app and stuff, but it doesn't really anymore. But when I'm at home, there's like no ads on anything. Everything is fast and everything is pretty great. And then when I come to the office and I'm like, oh, this is a different, all these ads, what are these? I never see these. And I have to think to myself like, oh, this is what everyone is used to seeing. And so like seeing ads and stuff like the Samsung ad on the top of the TechCrunch website, it's on the side too, and it's stuck there. And I can't do anything about it. And you know what? I get it. Like, got to make money somehow. Ads are the easiest way to do it. I completely 100% understand, but we've ruined it. And this, it's like on one end, this is why the Google AMP thing, now we're tying all this together. It's really nice. This is partly why I think savvy, intelligent people don't trust Google and AMP, is because they know that Google claims to make the majority of their revenue from ads. So then they make a platform or a solution that kind of eliminates ads, or like pulls them, extracts them from a website. That can't, you, as a business, you don't obsolete yourself without there being like an exit strategy to reinvent yourself. So if their strategy really is to just remove ads from the web, if that's what they were saying or not saying, and that's what they're developing, we all are like, yeah, but you're going to get us later. Like, you're going to eventually put ads in AMP, and you're going to put your own ads in my AMP, and I don't want that, and so I'm out. And it doesn't mean they're going to, and it doesn't mean that that's what they're saying or doing. I'm not trying to cast any judgment on anybody's intentions or anything at all. But it doesn't, it looks, the surface is not that obvious or straightforward. So what do you do about this? How do we, you know, that's the thing, is I don't just like ranting about this, because ads, like websites that have so many ads, they have more ads than
burn the mobile web to the ground and let's start over.
Didn't Marco Arment did a thing where he like somebody, I'm crediting the wrong person, maybe, did a whole comparison of like web page sizes and the amount of ads that they serve, where some websites were like 20 megabytes in size, of which 19 megs was ads. Like, it was just remote requests and ads in every direction. It wasn't even website content. The content is small and easy. Media, images, video, okay. But it was just all this JavaScript and all these ads. There was a whole write-up about everything from CNN to Fox to Mashable to whatever else. Man, we ruined it. What do we do? What do we do?
I don't know, but we got two more stories here. We'll wrap it up for you. Huge news out there for those of you who have been waiting for wildcard certificates from Let's Encrypt. Going live today, they've come out with Acme version 2, which is an updated version of the Acme protocol, which has gone through the IETF standards process, taking into account feedback from industry experts and other organizations that might use the protocol for certificate issuance and management someday. And the huge news about wildcard, or why so many people are happy about wildcard certificates, which are in by and large free, is that they allow you to secure all subdomains of a domain with a single certificate. So I'll ask you, John, this is if you're running a multi-site network, and all those multi-sites or subdomains, now you could use one wildcard SSL cert and cover them all, right?
Absolutely right. It's pretty dope, actually. Like, it, and from what I understand, and I'm looking at I had read it before, but I'm looking at the posts now in their forums. This is what I love about it, is this is an insane amount of work for them. Like, It is an unbelievable challenge to make this work for everyone at scale, the way that all of the web and wildcard certs and everything work. And so their blog post is so simple, like, hey, y'all, it's working. Like, go ahead and do it. It's okay.
They still recommend non-wildcard certificates for most absolutely use cases, right. Though. So.
Yep. But the multi-site thing is interesting. But then it's not uncommon to have multiple subdomains deep, right? Like for WordCamps, we have 2018.miami.wordcamp.org. And so each one, the wildcard doesn't cover the depth of each one. And so being able to have the right certificates for the right type of subdomain was really difficult before, because you would have to buy a new cert for every depth, for every permutation that you had, or issue a new cert or self-sign a cert to something else. It was not an easy problem to solve. And so this just erases that, which is kind of a huge deal. It's cool.
Now, your web host...
They're on schedule. They talked about shipping this the beginning of this year. It's on schedule. That's incredible.
In fact, they talked about having this back in December, back last year. You said it was coming in January. Now, the wildcard certificates are only available via Acme version 2. So your web hosting company is going to have to install or update to the Acme version 2 protocol for you to take advantage of wildcard certs from Let's Encrypt. But again, this is towards their mission. Let's Encrypt said, hey, let's secure the web. Let's HTTPS all the websites out there. And this is going to pave the way for a lot more people to be able to secure their website through HTTPS. Yep. And by and large, a lot of these web hosting companies out there, like Pagely recently and all these other sites, just one click. In one click, you could use a Let's Encrypt cert, and now you're using HTTPS on your site. Which is just a huge, huge improvement over what it used to be. Because I remember buying a cert was such a pain in the rear, and setting it up and making sure everything's right. Boy, have times changed.
And the first person, I guarantee you, the first person who automated cert issuance, everyone around them thought they were hacking. Like, oh, you can just create a cert out of nothing? Like, that's dangerous. That's too powerful. We're not ready for that yet. Whatever else. If wildcard subdomains and certs had launched at the same time, it almost would have been too soon. It would have been too much. And so what's a thing that is difficult today that will eventually be relatively automated? Like, just imagine a domain registration. If you just command line or a tool and go, hey, I want whatever, and then it just done, and it knows you, it signs you up, it's got your credit card or your Bitcoin or whatever else, and it takes it and it's done. And if in one command line you could just buy a domain, one command gets you a cert, a domain, wildcards, and everything, the first time someone does that, it will be a little magical, but it will also feel like sort of too powerful for people to use, I think.
So a little bit of event news before we wrap it up here. WP Campus, the in-person conference dedicated to WordPress and higher education, has announced its third annual event will take place this year, July 12th through the 14th at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Speaker call is open. It's open till April 7th. So if you're interested in speaking at a WordPress and higher education event, please reach out to them. And the event is 2 months after WordCamp St. Louis, which is also being held at Washington University. So they're expecting about 200 attendees this year. They are accepting sponsorship inquiries. And I believe there'll likely be a live stream of the event as well. Now, tickets are not yet available, but if you're interested, you can go to the 2018.wpcampus.org website. Sign up to a mailing list where you'll get information about that. Shout outs to Rachel Carden and everybody involved in putting that event together. This is the third in-person conference for WB Campus. The first was in 2016 in Sarasota, Florida, and the second was in Buffalo, New York, in 2017. So this will be the trifecta here. And to wrap it up, John, you will be at the big one, the Big Kahuna.
Sure will. Big,
WordCamp Miami this weekend.
That's right. WordCamp Miami, 10 years.
I just discovered that it will be live streamed. So
good. Yeah, it has been since several years now. So live streamed and everything.
I mean, we're talking about food trucks, WP e-commerce, or not WP. Jeez, where'd that come from? Well, WooCommerce, Workshop, Gutenberg, Workshop. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things, David, and the organizing team. Yeah, they do lots of workshops, kids workshops. They have a very
and no super, nor'easters. It'll be warm.
No, goodness, I'd hope not. they do such a good job in Miami. The whole team does of putting together workshops and events for the niche groups and the outliers and not that Gutenberg is an outlier, but doing a workshop on emerging tech. Really caters to what's coming. Miami and those folks have always done a really, really super good job at that.
So Matt Mulloway, I heard, will be there. So
oh yeah, Matt and I are and, we're doing a fireside chat together.
You interviewing him, or are you guys just gonna chat on stage? How's this gonna go?
I mean, it's supposed to be me interviewing him, but you know, Matt and I both like to wing it, so.
Well, hopefully your experience here on WordPress Weekly with the interviewing him on the Big 300, that'll come in handy, I'm sure.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, just
the 298 and the 300 or whatever it was. So what'll happen is we'll have
what if his microphone starts cutting out?
Cut out.
Yeah, I can't even get that right. So anybody going to WordCamp Miami this weekend, please search out the tall, the handsome.
Ooh.
The glasses, J-Trip.
Thank you.
Ask him about the BBs for me, please.
BBs, I may or may not have a very limited production run of Triple J t-shirts.
Oh, I did not know about that. I want one of those.
Yeah. I'll get you one.
So that's going to do it for this week's episode. I want a full detailed report of your experience of what it was like there at WordCamp Miami and next Wednesday's show.
Okay.
By you. You will be our correspondent there on the ground at WordCamp Miami.
So I need a microphone and like remote in and
nope, do everything by memory.
Oh, good. Yeah, I think we've written this several times firsthand about how terrible my recollection is of most of these things. So maybe I'll try and do better than that.
That's okay. We'll edit it. We'll edit it in post.
Good.
Yeah. Anyways, that's
because we're real good at that too.
Oh man, I forgot. I did have a pick this week. So before we wrap it up here, I have a pick this week. It's a resource on themeshaper.com called Designing Themes with Gutenberg Blocks and Sketch. And Kajal Regstad of, I believe, at Automatic, he's one of the designers there. He's created a set of what they call symbols. It's a sketch file that contains symbols for all of the default Gutenberg blocks, with the exception of embeds. And what this allows you to do is create a WordPress theme layout in Sketch. And with the symbols, you can place Gutenberg blocks in there and it gives you a good idea of what they might look like. And you could style them and edit them within Sketch and kind of give yourself a template to work towards in the actual WordPress.
Awesome.
And looking at his example, you could see that based on when he did his Sketch and then the result of it, he did it pretty quickly, very nice restaurant/brewery type website pretty quickly with Gutenberg blocks.
That's cool.
So I thought that was interesting. It's resource I'm going to share.
I like that even in the state of the word, didn't Matthias, I mean, there was a beer reference somewhere. Was it Matthias or Morton? Somebody used a book and then there was a beer reference. I like that theme continues on. Was it a commercial? Somebody used something. I have a pick of the week too, but you know, in typical me fashion, it has nothing to do with WordPress at all. So stop me if you want to keep it WordPress specific. But you know, we've talked about the Nintendo Switch and other junk in the past. So So I figured I would share. So in a past life, and I still a little bit today, I could move the camera and show off the DJ equipment that's in my office. But there's a company that you may have heard of called Pioneer. They make stereo equipment, whatever else. They have decent DJ gear, and they have what I think this month they are releasing what is like kind of the pinnacle of DJ controllers, you know, with the wiki wiki and the scratchy scratchy and, you know, all the beat matchy stuff. They're kind of have finally engineered like the thing that I have wanted for 20 years, and it's kind of cheap actually. And so it's a Pioneer DDJ 1000. Y'all can search for it on your own. I gave Jeff a copy for show notes. It's kind of a dorky thing, but it's kind of the parallels are interesting because they wrote their own software for handling tracks and they're sure there's software out there, but they had to solve the problem in interesting ways. So they have their own software to do it. The best DJs in the world have a tendency to use Pioneer's gear. And so this controller has me kind of excited about DJing again for the first time in a while. So that's my pick of the week, is the Pioneer DDJ 1000. It has nothing to do with WordPress at all. There's like tons of cool WordPress stuff going on, but I'm more excited about WordCamp Miami and the DDJ 1000 than Gutenberg or the rest of it. We talk about Gutenberg every week. When I saw this, I was like, oh, finally, something that's exciting. Something worth being excited about that isn't WordPress or Gutenberg. Okay. So that's my pick of the week.
Awesome. So that's going to do it for this episode of WordPress Weekly. You can find show notes for this episode and all other episodes on wptavern.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jeffro, JEFFR0, where I talk about my love of buttered popcorn, Jelly Belly, jelly beans. I love
and those. Your favorite pie.
Well, not yet. I haven't tweeted about my favorite pie, but I should on the day of.
What's your favorite train? I know you like trains. What's your favorite train?
Well, my favorite train company was back in the day. It was Conrail, Big Blue, they used to call it. It was blue and white, but it's since disappeared, like many other railroads, due to acquisitions. Consolidation. So there you go.
We have the small rail that you've probably seen the occasional photo of me take here. We is hooked up. Is Canada Rail? Is it? Someone else should know, and I used to know, and I'll figure it out. But
there's a Canadian Pacific, CN or CP, Union so Pacific. That's the yellow one.
You know, our little rail that just has trolleys that go back and forth from our village to the place that makes the amazing apple pies that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that rail line is connected to Canadian Pacific, I think, which is kind of crazy that, like, you know, 100 years ago, that's what they used to get most of the materials for all the homes and stuff where we live. Tangent, I suppose, but, you know.
All right, so what can people follow you on the social media?
How come you're not coming to WordCamp Miami this year? You've gone to Miami a bunch of years.
I haven't been able to get over that thing with planes yet.
Oh, yeah.
And personally, when I went to Miami, I didn't like Miami. I did not like the city. I didn't like the humidity. I just don't like Miami. Kind of like, you know, I don't like Nashville.
I didn't really enjoy living in Miami. But I love Miami as like a location and the culture and the people and everything else. But Miami didn't really treat me very well when I lived there. But I also was probably didn't really take advantage of all that Miami had to offer either.
So. Well, there's that. And I because English, I haven't done my due diligence of learning a lot of Spanish, and that kind of hurt. In the Miami area because of where they're at, the location and what have you. But I don't know. Miami's a beautiful weather-wise, except for the humidity. I hate
right with it.
Taking showers and feeling like you need to shower once an hour down there.
It is a little bit like that, but they have the best coffee, the best food, great beaches.
By the way, anybody out there, if you need an Uber driver or if you need somebody to drive you somewhere, John is well equipped to do that. And I won't tell the story of how I know that, but it was a very fun night.
I try to stay responsible and sober. I know my way around Miami, so I try to be helpful. And so if somebody is in desperate need of getting around Miami, just let me know. I'm happy to help.
All right. How can people follow you on Twitters and stuff?
You can follow me at AOL keyword JJJ, right? We established that last episode, don't?
Yes. Yes.
Twitter and GitHub at JJJ.
We'll talk to you again next Wednesday. We're going to end the show right at 4:14. So it's like an hour after Pi.
Perfect.
Hour after Pi. So it'd be perfect. So everybody enjoy the rest of your week. Have fun in Miami. John, well, I'll have fun here. And we'll talk to you again later. Say bye, John.
All right. Bye, Jeff. Bye, Jeff.